This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. This is Trainer Talk, and it is right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in the saddle with you for the next hour all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming live or podcast on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. My thanks to our sponsor of today's show, as it is each and every week, Fasig Tipton. They have just done fantastic work at the Fasig Tipton sales over the years, and they will continue to do so moving forward. My guest today is closing in on 900 career victories. His runners will soon eclipse, how about this, $30 million in career purse earnings, and he is fresh off yet another graded stakes score this past weekend when his four-year-old filly Miss Marissa wired the field in the Grade 2 Delaware Handicap. But you know, when you look at his record, his success really should come as no surprise. The native of Monmouth County, New Jersey, who grew up just a few blocks from Monmouth Park, has been winning races at the highest level of our sport since he first began training in 1977, including a horse you just may have heard of by the name of Unbridled Song, who took him on the ride of a lifetime 25 years ago. Please join me in welcoming trainer Jim Ryerson to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Jim, appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Yeah, looking forward to the visit. You know, when I thought about how I was going to open the show, and I wrote that line about it being 25 years since Unbridled Song competed in the Derby in 96, I had to check my math. It just doesn't seem like it's been that long ago, does it?
No, it actually doesn't. I'm actually parked here at Saratoga at Oklahoma, and it just doesn't seem that long ago. It's interesting because he broke his maiden here. I got the phone call from a very good friend who's since passed that Unbridled Song was sick, you know, and not doing well, you know, after had such a great stud career. And I remember it. I think I was here at Saratoga when I heard that. And it's time for Saratoga to open, and it's time to reflect on Unbridled Song, I guess, you know.
Yeah, but, considering the fact that he broke his maiden here.
It doesn't seem that long ago. You're right.
Yeah, I was really blown away because I remember vividly watching Unbridled Song go through his, not just his juvenile campaign, but then the three-year-old campaign leading up to the Derby, and of course, that which, by the way, the Derby Unbridled Song, I thought was one of the gutsiest races I've seen a racehorse run.
Yes, I mean, he really ran well. I think, the decision on my part to go with the, you know, the bar shoes, I think, was to protect him, and it did, and it actually did a very good job of doing that. But it's very hard for any, you know, for a horse to negotiate a mile and a quarter with, like, the two bars that he had. But he ran very well, you know, and just got beat for third, and he came back very good. And so on one hand, you're disappointed that he got beat, but on another hand, you're happy with how he came back. So, it's a little bittersweet, but that's part of the game.
You mentioned getting the word that he wasn't doing all that well when right before his death in 2013. He actually died July 26th of 2013, so we're coming up on that anniversary too. you didn't get a chance to visit him a whole heck of a lot when he was at stud, but when you got that call that he was gone, what do you remember about that day?
Well, I mean, I did have the one opportunity on a winter sale to make it out to TaylorMade, and they were good enough to show me him, and he was like white, and it was like snowing in the background. It was picturesque. He was very healthy at the time, and that was the only time I got to see him, but and during his stud career. The one thing, it was, you know, it was weird and, you know, kind of sad. And a good friend that who purchased the Unbridled Song was, you know, the Bloodstock agent, Buzz Chase. He had brain cancer also, and I think a lot of what happened with Unbridled Song was very similar. It was kind of weird, you know, kind of scary how it was interesting how it affected both of those my good friend and, you know, like one of the, you know, the best tours probably that I'll ever have the pleasure of training. So it was very kind of weird that way.
Yeah, very strange the way that all came together, and the similarities there. It's just it's a bit eerie when you think about that too, Jim.
Yes.
Really is. You know, when he was a youngster, Unbridled Song, you kind of had an inkling that maybe he could really run. And I've done some work here on the network. A mutual friend, jockey Herb McCauley, has worked with me here on the network and done some race broadcast coverage, sitting in as an analyst with us. And Herbie's one that really turned you on to Unbridled Song and said, okay, this horse might have some potential, didn't he?
Absolutely. We were at Mama's Park at the time. I had Herbie working a horse, a relaunch horse that we had purchased, and he was the company for Unbridled Song, and Barry Downs, his exercise boy, was on Barry Downs, and they were supposed to go a half, and it was easy, and it didn't go very fast. I mean, they went relatively fast, but I said, Herbie, how did the relaunch go? He said, well, he went all right, but that horse over there, he's a freak, he said. And that was fairly early on, and when Herbie told me, and he was prophetic in that, right?
Yeah, he certainly was. You know, Unbridled Song is as good as it gets, and the horse of a lifetime. You mentioned that term. He is the horse of a lifetime, and you think, okay, you get one like that as a trainer, you're thinking, all right, there's going to be more, right? And they just don't come along.
It's you know, the business. You think that, but sometimes it just leads. I don't know, people for one reason or another. I don't think necessarily the job that someone does. Sometimes it's just, I think they feel that, you know, they're not going to be sending as good a horse, and you're going to look down on their horse or what. But sometimes it does jettison someone's career, but oftentimes it doesn't. And sometimes you find it that actually people come out of it with less than more. So it can work both ways. And why it does, I can't really put a finger on it, but it can. It happens that it does sometimes.
Visiting with trainer Jim Ryerson here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Jim, take me back to August 26, 1995. It was the second race of the afternoon at Saratoga, Unbridled Song making his debut, and boy, what a show he put on that day. What do you remember about that afternoon?
I think they split the maiden race. I think there were two divisions. You know, to get to the maiden race, we had entered him at Monmouth prior. He drew the one hole. Mr. Paragallo didn't, you know, like that. It was pretty sizable field. And, you know, wanted a scratch out of the one hole and elected and asked if we could bring him up to Saratoga and run him. And after spiking a temperature and not being able to run one time here, he got in the race that you're talking about. And I think they split it. It was like an 8-horse field. And he just, dominated from start to finish and really probably had taken more of a deep breath on some of his works than he did that afternoon. I mean, he did that quite easily, and he showed that he was a quality, animal at that afternoon.
Yeah, of course, that led to the decision to run him in the Grade 1 Champagne at Belmont later that year. It was about 6 weeks after his maiden win. And he went off at 9-2 that day, I guess he was, if I recall, and had the big lead early and then couldn't hold on at the end. But what did you learn about Unbridled Song that day in defeat?
Well, number one, I think Richard Schatzberg's horse won that race. Maria's Mon, right?
Yeah, and, yeah, great memory.
Yeah, Maria's Mon was a nice, real nice horse. And, we just learned he displaced that day a little bit, and then it led us to the decision. You know, they had a tongue tie, and that's basically what we learned out of that. We kind of learned what equipment he wanted, and it ended up working out after that.
Yeah, it worked out beautifully in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, which was his third career start. He ends up winning that race by a neck over Hennessy, and Hennessy was a horse that came out of that same Champagne Stakes too. That crop that year was really pretty solid.
No, there were some very nice horses, from Skipaways to Nick Zito's horse, who won the Preakness as a 3-year-old. He had a very good 2-year-old year. To Richard, Richard was so unlucky with it, he couldn't come back at 3, but he was such a nice horse, and at 2, and Hennessy, as you said, there were a lot of nice 3-year-olds, in that year.
Yeah, let me go through the horses that finished behind him in that Breeders' Cup Juvenile for a minute for you. You had Hennessy, who he beat by a neck. Editor's Note was 4 lengths behind Hennessy. Then you had Honor and Glory, who finished 4th, and then Diligence, who was 5th. That's a pretty good top 5.
There was a ton of nice 3-year-olds that year, a ton of them, really.
Yeah. What allowed you, I know you mentioned the fact that maybe he displaced a bit in the Champagne, but what allowed you, Jim, to keep the faith and never lose faith in Unbridled Song going into that Breeders' Cup Juvenile?
Well, I mean, really just, I mean, his, first of all, he would do things so easily. He looked like, and oftentimes, like he was just galloping and on many occasions didn't look like he really would, drop down, and so it looked like he kind of had more to give. So you always felt, there's just untapped talent here, just had more and more, that he could give. So to run in a Breeders, first of all, we were up at Belmont at the time, so the Breeders' Cup was there. I mean, he had a very good excuse in the Champagne. And the Breeders' Cup's in your own backyard, and so you that was the hope all along. That was where we were heading all along, and we didn't let the Champagne really change us up on that because we knew he had a lot of talent.
How much Unbridled Song memorabilia am I going to see at Jim Ryerson's house or at your barn if I go in?
Well, we have a lot of pictures. We have, a few trophies. We have many pictures. But what's funny is we call it the Unbridled Song Suite. We have, I think I put an addition on my house. But more than memorabilia, that he's a life-changing horse. I went to Stud, and I was lucky enough to get a breeding right in, a yearly breeding right, and it just it changes your life. It helps put your kids through college. It's there's a lot of memorabilia associated with unbridled soul.
It's interesting you should say that, because when I've interviewed Bill Mott in the past on this very same show, he'll talk about theatrical and how he was the horse that, you know, he paid for his house, and he allowed Bill Mott to eventually become the Bill Mott that we know today. Same thing with the Reeves, Patty and Dean Reeves, who own Mucho Macho Man. I had a chance to visit with them at their house in the Atlanta, Georgia area. And, Jim, they have a whole room dedicated to Mucho Macho Man with saddle towels right. and trophies. And it's amazing what a horse like this can do for an owner and for a trainer.
No question. I mean, and when you see that talent and you live through that time, sometimes it does make it. It's when they leave and when they're and you take on other horses to train for other people, it does take some getting used to that. You know, you what happens is. I think it's by nature, but you start to compare horses to him, and that's not fair. You know, so there's an adjustment that you have to, you know, but they change your life for the moment that you kind of go through it a little bit.
What is your personal all-time favorite unbridled song moment, whether it's a race or just something he did off the track that you're never going to forget? What's that one moment for you, Jim?
Boy, that's hard. That might be hard. I don't know. I think it's a race. I think when we bring him back at three, the first race to Hutchinson, we were a little behind schedule, but we really, at the time there, the progression of those races, we didn't want to miss the Hutchinson, yet we were a little lacking there. And Ben Perkins' horse beats us. That was fun. But we ran great. We were second, and we moved forward off that. But then we moved to Fountain of Youth, and we get beat us up by a $200 horse, I think, for Tommy Hurd. But we again moved forward. But I'm getting in a little heat, so we're not winning. So there's a little bit of pressure there, but you know what? You got to try and keep it all in perspective, because, and that's what the guys that have the horses, the Baffert's, the Nick Zito's, the Wayne Lucas's, the Todd Pletcher's, they're preps. They're not the race. So the Florida Derby, I would say, is the time that for me, and him was his best moment for us, because it was a great field, and he literally, put them away, and very easily. And that was probably the best moment I had with him.
Yeah, defeated Editor's Note, Skip Away, and Louis Couture's, and he drew off and won by 5 3/4 lengths that day. In the Florida Derby, it was a tour de force type of performance, and certainly one my special guest Jim Ryerson is never going to forget. You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jim, the relationship between you and owner Ernie Paragallo had its ups and downs. There's no doubt about that, and it kind of came to a head later in the season after the Kentucky Derby. The horse was moved to the barn of trainer Nick Zito. Considering the fact that Unbridled Song meant so much to you and to your family, that just had to be gut-wrenching, was it?
In terms of, the time that he made a change in trainer?
Yeah, that has to be difficult, considering how much Unbridled Song meant to you.
I think any time you have a horse, a quality that you lose... Ernie basically, he said to me, And I think Ernie thought, you know, it's not that he didn't think of me in terms of the move, but I think he felt that the horse needed more and it wasn't going in the right direction, so he needed to make a change. And, you know, you have to, in this business, you have to acknowledge that those things can happen and you just, you know, you turn the page. Yes, I think sometimes it's harder on the family, you know, it's your family, because they're so emotional about it, yet they don't deal in the business on a day-to-day basis. So someone who does like myself, it's like coaching, it's, you know, that sort of thing. If you don't win, it's part of the business. You know, somebody, you know, the odds are good. In some cases, you're going to get replaced. Now, there's some owners that can ride through that, and there's some that can't. And I'm not saying that Ernie wasn't a loyal person in that regard. He just, I think, he had so much at stake with that, with Unbridled Song himself, that I think it just, in his mind, it required that sort of move. So it's tough, but you have to, you know, if you deal in this type of business long enough, it's something that can happen.
I've never had a trainer in all the years I've been doing this show, 10 years or so of Trainer Talk now, Jim, point out the fact that it can be harder on the family than it can be on the actual trainer when a horse of this caliber is taken away and given to another trainer. And it's a great point. How old were your children in the mid-90s as Unbridled Song was doing his thing?
Boy, you're going to get me in trouble now with the ages, but...
Approximate.
You know, I'm thinking the boys were, you know, 95, you're talking about 25. You know, they were in the 15 to 13 ages,
okay.
You know, years old and stuff. And they're loving the game, and they're loving it. I mean, there's not, you know, and Caitlin is a little younger than that, but they're loving it, and I think they feel bad for you. They feel bad for me, you know, but I think they just feel bad. They're sad, and I think they feel bad for the dad, and you know, and that, and it's hard. It's hard on the family. It's just hard on the family.
Yeah, and plenty old enough to become attached to the horse and know what's going on, and you know, those types of things too. So I completely get it, and it's an interesting way to look at it. Like I say, no trainer has ever brought that up to me before, and I think it's a wonderful point. And Jim, you handled the situation with absolute class back then. You answered the question here today with absolute class too, and I think you have to if you're going to go forward in this game and look to get those types of horses back in your barn again.
No, you know, those are decisions, and you know, I've had other ones come across where the changes are made, but I think I think it can come back around. You try not to burn any bridges, and there's, you know, there's been a good many times that it has come all the way around. So you know what, it's the owners, they have a lot invested, and they have their reasons for doing things, but you know, so you have to, I think, give them that latitude and give them that respect, and hope, and then sometimes they do come back around, and sometimes it's better than the first time, and it will surprise you sometimes.
It's an experience that you learn from and you grow from, and you move forward from something like that, and you hope that you come out the other side even better and stronger, and you certainly have, still training greatest stakes winners all these years later. So many trainers on this show, Jim, have told me about the fact that they never stop learning. Are you still learning even today with your job?
I mean, the things that you come across, the situations, you'll never see it all. These are living, breathing animals that have minds of their own, and the oddest things can happen to them, and they can get themselves in situations you would never, you know, expect in terms of even in their own stalls, and how a little their halter can get hung up on a little double end snap that just left open just a hair, you know. It's just amazing. They find trouble and they find ways to get hurt, and so there's just you never see it all, really.
Yeah, talking with trainer Jim Ryerson here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. He's been training since 1977, and he has certainly had more good horses than just Unbridled Song. We spent a lot of the first half of the program, most of it, as a matter of fact, talking about Unbridled Song, but rightfully so, one of the greatest horses that we have seen on the racetrack, and Jim was the man who guided him through the majority of his career. Jim, stay with me. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the early days of Jim Ryerson. We'll go back to growing up around Monmouth and talk about how you got started in the sport. We'll do that when we come back. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This summer, Fasic Tipton celebrates the 100th renewal of the Saratoga Sale, the world's most prestigious auction of selected yearlings in a single catalog. A sale that has produced 100 years of Breed Shapers, Eclipse Champions, Classic Winners, and International Stars. Join us for the Sale of a Century, the 100th Fasic Tipton Saratoga Sale, August 9th and 10th in Saratoga Springs, New York. Where will you be?
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Wide open in the juveniles, the field turns for home on Unbridled Song, taking the lead as the field turns for home. On the outside, Hennessy and those two will come down to the final furlong together. Hennessy in a pull-out drive, Unbridled Song giving his all toward the rail. By the back, Hunter and Corey is now running in third. Editor's Note is fourth. Unbridled Song and Hennessy in a duel down to the line. Unbridled Song, Hennessy, here's the wire, and it is Unbridled Song who wins by a head. A hard-fought head it was over Hennessy this afternoon in the juvenile. He usually goes right to the lead, not today. Off the pace, a brief but brilliant season for Unbridled Song.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, visiting with trainer Jim Ryerson, the trainer of Unbridled Song, and so many other top horses, which we will talk about here in the second half of the show. Tom Durkin had the call of that Breeders' Cup Juvenile, and it was a gutsy effort. I can remember sitting there at Belmont Park. It was before my wife and I had moved to Kentucky, and we were living in Massachusetts and made the trip down to Belmont for that race and for the day. And it's a race I'll never forget, not because of Unbridled Song, but because of the lady that was sitting in front of us who was cheering for Seacliff, and she had a high-pitched voice, and it was Seacliff the whole way through the race, and I'll never forget it. We still talk about it to this day, and Seacliff, of course, went on to finish 10th that day. Unbridled Song got the victory for Jim Ryerson and for the team. We'll continue the conversation momentarily, but want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, you can head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcast from. Well, Jim, that was a moment that I know you're never going to forget. We talked about it in the first half of the program, but yeah, that the Seacliff thing is something that is always going to stand out to me when I think back on that Breeders' Cup Juvenile.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's something I'll never forget. But Unbridled Song gets the victory and adds to the total of Jim Ryerson, the native of New Jersey, who got started with his training career in the 1970s, right around 1977. Jim, take me back to the beginning. Where did the love of horse racing begin for you?
Well, I was 15 years old, and looking for a summer job, and my dad lined up through Jim. There's a Branchport Market near Monmouth Park, and a lot of trainers used to shop there for meat and stuff. And Jim Pascucci lined me up to go to work for a trainer named Les Lear, who trained a very good horse named Sadair. And Les was a Canadian football player, retired football player, and he raced during that time, like from on the Florida, New Jersey circuit. And then later on, I think he from the Florida, he went back to Canada. But I got started with him when I was 15, and I worked for him at Monmouth in Atlantic City, and then I would go back to school, and I worked for him three straight summers until he stopped coming back. And then I went to work for a trainer named John Simmons at Monmouth and Atlantic City. And then I tried college after that.
Tried college. How'd that go?
it went in spurts. it didn't work out too. It didn't work out too well at her sinus. And then I came home, and my mom said, "That's okay. You know, if you're going to go to work, but please don't go to the racetrack." She didn't want me to go to the racetrack. So I tried college again. And I did a little bit at Rutgers, but I never got a degree. And then finally, my mother succumbed to the fact that I wanted to go to work at the racetrack. And I went to work for John Tamaro III. I just remember Whitey Mikowski and then John Tamaro III. And I guess that's in the early to mid-70s. I was to John between Maryland and New Jersey.
Those are some pretty big names that you threw out. John Tamaro, you know, the third, fantastic. What did you learn from him that helped you get started?
Well, Johnny had he had young horses and claiming horses, and he had a division that he would split at times. And my good friend Joe Devereaux kind of ran the Maryland one, and I got left for a fall at Jersey when we split, you know, when we had two different divisions. So the one thing it left me on my own to carry out, you know, some things for John up there, and he had a lot of he also had a lot of babies, which my wife would tell you that I probably didn't do any too good in this business until I got some clients with some young horses, really, you know. And seemed like that's been the difference in my career, really, when I started getting young horses for different people. I still like to claim because it's a big segment of the business, but I think most people would say that, you know, I'm more known for developing, you know, horses.
Yeah, it's a reputation that you've earned, and rightfully so. What's the key to working with young horses and developing them in the right way?
The first thing is patience, I think. I think you get a feel for when to go and when to hurdle, basically, like when to go forward and when to back off a little. And it's like, to me, I try to describe it as like two steps forward, one back, three steps forward, two back, you know, like it's just, you just try to read the horse and his development and what he may need to get there. If you're paying attention, you can kind of see when they start to fight it a little bit, physically, mentally, and then you try and adjust to that and slow up, and then you go forward. And I think that's, I've had a little bit of a connection with that.
I know, Jim, that you probably had horses that you thought were going to turn out to be really nice and they just didn't progress the way that you thought they were going to. Tell me about the flip side of that. Have you ever had, and I'm sure you have, a horse that maybe you kind of doubted and thought, okay, this youngster maybe just doesn't quite have what it takes, and all of a sudden they figure it out and they turn out to be a really nice horse?
I don't know. I've had a horse. The closest thing to that for me wouldn't be a horse that I didn't think was okay, but a horse that maybe he outperformed my early expectations, and that would be a horse called Park Avenue Ball.
Mm-hmm.
He was a nice horse, and he could run, but I never pictured him winning $1 million or that sort of thing. And what people might think, well, underplay that and say, well, he's a Jersey bred, and you know, there was a lot out there for Jersey breds, and he won $1 million. He only ran in two Jersey bred races his whole career, his maiden race and a three-year-old stake at the end of his three-year-old year. Other than that, he ran open his whole career, and he won graded races throughout. And I would have thought he would be a nice horse, but I never would have thought he would have attained what he did.
Yeah, I'll remember Park Avenue Ball. He raced in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile at Monmouth in 2007. That was our first ever radio broadcast of the Breeders' Cup, and we've been doing it every year since on national radio. So it was a special day for me, but I'll never forget the weather that day. My goodness, it poured,
Jim. Terrible day.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, at that time, he had finally undergone like a tieback operation. His wind had compromised him so much, and he didn't run well that day, but we took a shot because Charlie and Marianne Hess were such Monmouth people, the Breeders' Cup had come to town, and so we really tried to have him be that kind of horse. That was the only year he didn't win a graded. He was second and just got beat in the 7/8 race at Gulfstream, a good sprint early in the year. But his wind just got so bad after that we took the shot and did a tie back on him for the Breeders' Cup, but he didn't run well that day.
Yeah, New Jersey connections through and through. Marianne Hess and Charlie, New Jersey natives, and yourself a New Jersey native, and then Park Avenue Ball, New Jersey bred. Talk about the relationship with Marianne and Charlie.
Well, they loved, they just supported everything about Mama. I mean, Charlie was, you know, Park Avenue Ball, if he was in, you know, owned by someone, you know, a lot of other people probably would have went to the Derby, but Charlie really wasn't interested in the Derby. He was more interested in trying to win a Haskell. And Park Avenue Ball really wasn't a mile and a quarter horse or a Derby type of horse, but he was a very good three-year-old. He competed well in the Florida Derby and just got beat in the Withers. And he was a nice three-year-old, but he really probably didn't want to go as far as a mile and a quarter. And Charlie didn't care about that. He was just hoping that he could, you know, win a Haskell with him. And the horse just, his breathing just really compromised him. Yet, not as much as you would think. I tell people he made $500,000. Not making any noise, and he made it 500 more thousand or more making a terrible noise to make over $1 million, and then finally he just couldn't breathe. He couldn't breathe, you know, to win any more races. But I was disappointed. He ran very well in his Haskell for Charlie and Marianne. He was third, and I felt so good to win the Islam for Charlie the following year, and then Charlie passed I think later that year or early the next year.
Yeah, a special relationship and a special horse. And it just goes to show you, Jim, that sometimes you just can't measure what's inside of a horse. It's like any athlete, right? It's that heart that gets them through. And even though he had to overcome all those different issues you just outlined, he still was able to do it. And it's all because of that heart that a horse like Park Avenue Ball has.
Yes, that's what you can't measure. So when you see him as a young two-year-old, he's a nice horse, but I never would have imagined that he would accomplish the things that he did. And that's off from, as you say, his heart, really.
How long does it usually take you when you start working with a young horse to know if they have some kind of potential?
I kind of use the 5/8 and a little bit like a barometer in terms of, you know, a lot of horses will come to you, they'll run, you know, they can work nice 3/8, a half, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, they start to separate themselves to me, you know, when they reach the 5/8 in terms of their ability. And then it's not only how they do that, it's then how they carry themselves. Is that how much of that is nerves or how much is that? But you can't run too far on nerves alone. So the 5/8 kind of is where I kind of separate them, you know, a little bit.
Talking with trainer Jim Ryerson here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. We played the call of Unbridled Song winning the Breeders' Cup Juvenile coming back from the commercial break a short time ago, Jim, and that was a trip down memory lane. I'm going to take you on another one here. I'm going to mention the name of this next horse, and I know it's a special horse for you. The name is Meadow Flight. Tell me more about Meadow Flight.
Well, Meadow Flight was a meadow lake, and I should certainly remember the sire of the dam, but
Cormorant, right? Wasn't he out of a Cormorant
York,
mare?
Yeah, New York sire, Cormorant dam, and I think Leon Bluson was training the dam. And she was a real mile on 800s. And, of course, Meadow Lakes, everybody said they can't, you know, speed, or they won't go that far, blah, blah, blah. And when we purchased them, and Buzz Chase was part of that, and we purchased them for a gentleman named Leonard Pivnik, who ran under the Allie Ely Benjay stable name. And Leonard was a brother of a woman that I trained for named Audrey Berman, and he called me one day, said he wanted to get into business, and he said he bought some young horses, and Meadow Flight was the first horse he purchased at auction, and it was a great trip from, you know, he of course ran well and as a two-year-old. And then we went to Hialeah, and our hopes were the Flamingo, that was one of the bigger days in my, you know, and as far as my racing career, I think, as for me personally, winning that race with Meadow Flight for that family of the Pivniks. We had a nice long relationship, and he was one of the first clients that really gave me like a little bit of a bankroll and said, find me some horses. And, you know, and Buzz, of course, helped me with that in terms of the choices. But it's nice when it all works out. It doesn't often work out. It's nice when it does.
Was that kind of the beginning of the rise to the next level for you, Jim, when you had somebody like that that believed in you and gave you the bankroll and said, here, go get it done? Was that the start?
Yeah, I think that year, the one thing that happened that year, and I think not only did Ernie take notice of that, and so when the choice came for Unbridled Song, there was a lot of good choices of people to give the horse to, and I happened to maybe be on, you know, I was on that list, but it was probably because of Meadow Flight that I got myself on that list. in the year that he had at three, winning the Flamingo, running second to Holy Bull in the Haskell, and then winning the Pennsylvania Derby. I think Ernie, you know, through Buzz, you know, took note of that a little bit, and people like Al Carpenito later on. And so, yes, I think Metal Flight was a big part of that.
Yeah, I'll have to tell you, you mentioned the Haskell. Holy Bull is my all-time favorite horse, so as much as I would cheer for Metal Flight, I couldn't cheer for you that day, Jim.
Yes, no. And Jimmy's horse was... I would try to find weaknesses in him. I had to, you know, running it, you know. But he's just, you know, some of the things he did, that's in another subject, but some of the things Holy Bull did to me were just unbelievable, really.
Yeah.
And I go towards getting pulled up in Florida when the Hair beat him, I think, or the Frey, I get them mixed up, to coming back and winning the Florida Derby. Taking him to Churchill, getting beat in the Derby, and I was alongside him when he did. And then when, you know, Jimmy Ryerson, I hate to say it, is going to probably want to run in a Dwyer or something like that. And Jimmy, God bless him, he says, no, I'm going to run him in the Met Mile. He runs him in the Met Mile and he beats them. Some of the things he did, you know, to me were just unbelievable.
I'll never forget, I had the chance to somehow, my seats at Saratoga ended up next to Jimmy Kroll one time, and it was just amazing for me, being a fan of Holy Bull, to spend time with him. And I only wish that I was doing radio back then, and I wish I had this show back then, because I would have loved to have spent time talking with Jimmy Kroll.
Yes. No, his handling of that horse, he used to say to me, boy, these other guys, they got four or five. We got to take care of our only one. But he put him out there and he put him in some spots that to me, I look back and I say, oh my God, how's he doing that? And he would do it and he would win. And like the Met Mile to me after the trouncing in the Derby to me is like, wow. It's not like you're trying to find a spot to build his confidence up. He went right after the best. I mean, it's unbelievable to me, really.
Yeah, simply incredible. Jim Ryerson, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Jim, if you were to take your Mount Rushmore of trainers, and you were to create a Mount Rushmore of trainers, which trainers are going to be on there for you as some of the greatest trainers of all time?
Well, I mean, that's terrible. There's so many, you know, great horsemen, and really good horsemen people don't even hear about. But if you said to me, that's really hard.
How about the greatest trainers you've had the chance to be around? Maybe that's an easier way to do it.
I'm going to say one thing. I mean, I think there's such a group of trainers that have different strengths in them. And I think Wayne Lucas's, to me, was, and I give Wayne credit, because when you have a horse and they get beat for, and you have expectations and they get beat. Sometimes for me, you know, it was always, you know, then you don't want that to happen again. And so you try and find a softer spot and try to build the horse's confidence up. And Wayne, if he believed in a horse, he would keep him trying, and so oftentimes would turn it around and be able to knock off one or two of those races, where sometimes someone didn't have that belief in the horse, or whose belief got hurt a little bit, would duck and try and find an easy, and that would never be Wayne. Wayne would never do that. He would always, to me, take on the challenge if he believed in the horse, and a lot, and more often than not, it worked out. The cat thief and this and that, that you know, that sometimes ran poorly, but he never gave up on, and then they turned it around. If you do this for a living, you know sometimes how hard that is to do based on expectations of the owner, expectations of the public, to try to put yourself out there like that is not easy. And I give him a lot of credit for that. In terms of who you know, I have certain people that I believe, you know, have, you know, could in that arena have brought horses and to the you know, the Triple Crown, and I was able to participate a couple times, so I was around them, and I thought the Dale Romans, I thought the Nick Zito, the Bob Baffert, you know, those guys, there's just the what they knew what to do with that in that sort of arena, and I think Kenny McPeak, and you get that experience. That is hard. It's hard to replicate for someone who hasn't been there, and it's so different. And people really don't, unless you've been there. It's just different. It takes a lot. The Triple Crown, the first Saturday in May. What you have to have in a horse that they can come out of it without the wear and tear of that race, that you can go on and have a nice 3-year-old year. I think those guys know what it takes, and there's more. I'm leaving some people out, and I'm not coming up with names, but there's other people that I would have no problem giving them that type of horse to also, but. It's experience does play a factor to me in that, because it is so much different than most of the races that you see on a daily basis. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's incredible. Jim Ryerson has answered so many questions over the years and answered them with absolute class, and he handled that one too. Jim, I'm going to be honest with you. That's the first time I've ever asked a trainer that particular question on this show. In all the years I've been doing it, I typically like to ask trainers who they would like to spend the day with, if they could spend a day hanging out and asking questions of another trainer. But I threw you a curveball, and you knocked it out of the park. So well done on that front, my friend.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, well done. What do you think, Jim? I'll give you a much easier question here. What do you think is the one thing you like most about being a horse trainer and doing this for a living?
Well, the thing that I think a lot of, first of all, I think, you know, I don't know. I grew up playing a lot of sports. I grew up being like on teams, this and that. You work for a comical. What I like doing is an owner giving me a horse, letting me try and do the best I can with it. We work together. We try and accomplish some things and grind out a career for that horse that, you know, and I think that the people that you help, at the barn, your owner, if you really love the game, we need people to gamble on the horses because that's what drives the business, and there's a lot of let me tell you that I really like appreciate some of the guys that do that, and I know, and it's interesting that the types that really like horse racing as an outlet for that, and I commend them. But to me, it's working with the horses, working with an owner, trying to have horses run well, and we appreciate the work you put in and also the results. Knowing that you can't win all the time, but if you can represent well and do and pay, have horses perform well most of the time, that they appreciate that and you feel good. That's what I like. That's what I like about it.
Jim, down to about a minute and a half left in the show. It's been so much fun to hear your story, and can't thank you enough for the visit here today. It's just been wonderful. I always like to wrap it up just by asking trainers to let me know something about them that people might not know. So if you do get time away from the racetrack, in 30 seconds or less, what do you enjoy doing not at the racetrack?
Well, if I'm not at the racetrack, and the racetrack takes up so much of your time, basically what I enjoy doing, to tell you the truth, is either going home in the backyard at the pool and having the grandchildren come over and we have a cookout, or my wife and I going to a local place on the Jersey Shore and sitting at the bar and having a couple drinks and a couple appetizers. And that's about what I get. Maybe I'll get a few minutes on a beach late afternoon on the Jersey Shore. That's probably my life right there.
That's all you need. He's trainer Jim Ryerson, my special guest. Jim, thanks for the visit, my friend. Appreciate the time.
Hey, Mike, thank you.
All right, Jim Ryerson. My thanks to Jim. My thanks to my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios. I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.